Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's National Immigration Forum call on COVID-19 and immigration. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Please note this call may be recorded. I will be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ali Noorani. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for joining this morning. I appreciate the efforts by the call service to process folks through. I know everybody's short staff and technology is challenged these days, so I appreciate everybody's patience. And I also just want to begin with our hopes that, and thoughts that everybody on the call, as a speaker, as a audience member, that your families are safe and healthy in this very challenging, unsettling time. So really appreciate everything that everybody's doing, and our hope everybody is, again, safe and healthy. So the purpose of this call this morning is to begin to lay out what we believe is necessary for the administration and Congress to do to protect the health and the safety of the immigrant community, which we will argue is core to continuing to protect the health and the safety of all Americans. This is an urgent moment for Americans across the country. The treatment of COVID-19 is clearly the greatest public health challenge of our lifetimes, with major consequences for our families, our economy, and our way of life. As I've been talking to colleagues and policymakers across the country, as stories of immigrant families impacted by COVID-19 emerge, it's clear that the economic dominoes that are falling on almost every household are falling hardest on the most vulnerable, immigrant households among them. As COVID-19 spreads through our cities and towns, common sense policies that serve and protect immigrants and refugees is absolutely critical in terms of keeping the American people safe. The fact is that COVID-19 makes no distinction between citizens, permanent residents, visa holders, and people who are undocumented. That's why the Trump administration and Congress must prioritize the health and safety of all community members, including immigrants and refugees. So today we're calling on the administration and Congress to release a comprehensive, transparent plan immediately, which enables immigrants and refugees to access programs and services and to contribute to our healthcare system, our economy, and our communities without fear of deportation. Furthermore, we believe that it's imperative that in order to protect the health of the public, the administration must move forward with the release of nonviolent immigrant detainees in detention facilities across the country. This call will address three distinct issues. First, the health and safety of those detained or working in immigration detention facilities. Second, the ability of the entirety of the immigrant community to access critical programs and services. And third, the need for continued visa processing to ensure a stable workforce. Our speakers this morning will speak to different components of this request, this plan. Jason Tamara, the Forum's Vice President of Policy and Advocacy, Galen Carey, Vice President of Government Relations with the National Association of Evangelicals, Ashley Feasley, Director of Policy for Migration and Refugee Services at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, Sandra Galea, the Dean of the Boston University School of Public Health, retired Chief James Lopez, who served with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, and then Craig Regelbrook, Senior VP for Advocacy and Research at American Heart. After short statements by each speaker, we will take questions, so please be ready with those questions. Let's begin with Jacinta Ma, the Forum's Vice President of Policy and Advocacy. Jacinta.
Thank you, Ali. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining today. Managing COVID-19 is about implementing sound and effective policy. The government's efforts to address COVID-19 have upended immigrants' lives just as they have for everyone else. Their actions have touched almost every aspect of immigration policy as well. Since the beginning of this month, at least 30 different immigration policy changes have been implemented. These policies range from whether an immigrant is able to access health care, to whether they can get a visa or naturalize, to whether they can seek asylum, to whether they will be able to be protected from the virus as they continue their essential work on the front line. And these are just a few of the many policies that questions have been asked during this time. Without a clear plan to address COVID-19 that takes immigrants into account, the risks and harms associated with coronavirus will increase for both citizens and non-citizens. The Trump administration should issue a plan that answers how to reduce the health risks of detaining nonviolent immigrants in crowded facilities, and to reduce these health risks not only for immigrants, the detainees, but also the guards, the maintenance staff, and other workers, as well as the attorneys and immigration court staff who may be exposed to these immigrants as well as they go to court. And how to ensure immigrants, especially those with U.S. citizen children, have affordable access to health services and are not afraid to use those health services. How to ensure that immigrant doctors, home health care workers, researchers, and agricultural workers and other workers can continue to play a vital frontline role during this pandemic while being afforded adequate protection from COVID-19. And lastly, how to provide economic relief regardless of immigration status so that we stimulate economic growth and make sure all families and children can meet their basic needs and stay healthy during this crisis. I'm happy to go into more policy specifics during the question and answer period. Thank you.
Thank you, Jacinta. Galen Carey, Vice President of Government Relations for the National Association of Evangelicals. Galen.
Thank you, Ali. Good morning. I'm Galen Carey, representing the National Association of Evangelicals. Our mission is to honor God by connecting and representing evangelical Christians, which include many immigrants from around the world. Evangelicals believe that every person is valuable because we are each made in the image of God. As has already been said, the coronavirus uniquely demonstrates the folly of excluding any member of our community because viruses know no borders and they do not discriminate on immigration status. Therefore, it is imperative that medical services be made available to all members of our community. If immigrants are sick and afraid to seek help or have to work, that complicates the process of combating the virus for all of us. Economic assistance and worker protections must also be extended to all members of our community and to all workers, which prohibits or discourages immigrants from seeking assistance must be explicitly suspended during the COVID-19 pandemic with regard to any aid that is received during this time. And most importantly, these policies must be put in place at federal, state, and local levels and clearly and publicly articulated, starting with President Trump, so that every person in our nation understands that they can get the help that they need and that they can be part of the solution as we work together to overcome this crisis. Thank you.
Thank you, Galen. Our next speaker is Ashley Feasley, Director of Policy of Migration and Refugee Services Offices of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. Ashley, thank you.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. My name is Ashley Feasley, and I'm the Director of Policy for Migration and Refugee Services at the USCCB. The Catholic Church's deep concern for people seeking safety and access to health care during this pandemic is grounded in our Catholic social teaching and our collective experience serving people in need. The core tenet of our faith is the belief that every human life is sacred. And in promotion of that belief, we're advocating and providing service for all, but especially the most vulnerable, whether it be the unborn, the poor, the homeless, immigrants and refugees, the elderly, and the mentally and physically infirm. And so it is in this light that we look at this situation and recognize that this is not a migration issue, but a public health and a human life issue. It's really important that we, at this time, make sure that all populations, especially those who could be vulnerable, such as the undocumented or asylum seekers, are able to access the type of testing and care that are necessary to help prevent the spread of the COVID-19 virus. It's really important also, I think, that we have a plan to ensure the health and safety of asylum seekers waiting along the border of Mexico for their hearings in the U.S. and, you know, remembering that they're in close quarters and they are vulnerable to the outbreak. We have a continuing responsibility, I think, to make sure that all individuals here are safe. They're able to, you know, safely access care and access to testing as they need it. But also the families, many families who may have an undocumented member, live in a mixed status family, are able to access protections and resources to ensure that they will be able to not have to make that terrible choice between seeking health care and paying for food or shelter for their families. You know, I'm happy to answer questions on this in the future, but I do want to say that we are in this moment not thinking about this as migration policy, but really an articulation of public health that needs to be disseminated and describing how we can all make sure that we as a society are safer.
Thank you, Ashley. Our next speaker is Chief James Lopez, retired, served with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Chief Lopez.
Good morning, and thank you, Ali. As a former division chief of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, law enforcement agencies were now facing a new challenge. Before, their focus was primarily on public safety. Now it must be their focus must be public health as well as public safety. Coronavirus threatens to spread rapidly within detention facilities, where the two precautions for safely living through this pandemic that we've been given by the medical experts, social distancing and quarantine, are not feasible. Neither of them are feasible. Detention facility leaders, be they state prisons, county jails, or immigration facilities, have a legal and ethical responsibility to provide for a duty of care for every detainee. They have no doubt begun marshaling their resources and emergency planning in the event of a COVID-19 outbreak. Detention facilities have dedicated medical professionals, at least the ones that I'm familiar with, doctors, nurses, healthcare practitioners working in their detention infirmaries. Despite their dedication, their facilities are not designed to handle this type of a medical emergency. Those detainees who become acute patients will not be treated at the facility infirmary, but will be transported to local medical hospitals, further stressing critically scarce resources. Immigration detention facilities should follow the lead of several large custody facilities across the country by developing a contingency plan to release detainees who do not pose a threat or a danger to public safety, to reduce the risk, essentially. Otherwise, we risk using up medical supplies on people who could have been released prior to catching the virus and will needlessly put communities at risk. All options should be considered while options are still available. Excuse me. Once the detainee population become exposed to COVID-19, those options will no longer be available. Reducing the at-risk population of detainees is a worthy and viable option. I urge immigration detention facilities to develop a plan to remove detainees who pose no public threat, those who negatively test positive for COVID-19, have family ties to the community, will self-quarantine, maybe be electronically monitored, so the threat of the spread of COVID-19 is minimized. We can continue to discuss immigration policy when the COVID-19 crisis is over. Now is the time for thoughtful and decisive leadership to protect life, preserve vital medical resources, and reduce the threat of this public medical crisis. Thank you for allowing me to express my opinion.
Thank you so much, Chief Lopez. Our next speaker is Sandra Galea, Dean of the Boston University School of Public Health. Sandra.
Thank you, Ali. As Ali mentioned, I'm the Dean of the Boston University School of Public Health, and I think the simplest way of describing what's happening right now is a public health crisis. I think it's a public health crisis for all populations, and it's particularly a public health crisis for marginalized populations and immigrant populations, central among those. As Chief Lopez said, our country's immigration detention facilities were not designed for physical distancing. They're not designed to be able to provide critical care that it will be needed if a COVID-19 outbreak will occur. In many respects, this is a problem of our own creation, and there are simple ways to solve this. I think in the interest of public health, we need to test detainees and release healthy, nonviolent detainees. There is absolutely no reason why, facing this pandemic, we are not doing that. I think this will protect the health of the immigrants, of officers, of staff, and of community overall. Everybody who is sick, regardless of their immigration status, has to be treated as appropriate, has to be quarantined and kept away from others. Otherwise, we are all going to be even more vulnerable. This is, frankly, public health and epidemiology 101, in that you do not want to have reservoirs of illness, regardless of where they are, because it will make everybody sick as well as the reservoirs themselves. The other aspect of this, which is slightly different, is that immigrants are key to the solution. Immigrants are on the front lines of treating the coronavirus and finding vaccine. They are doctors, nurses, home care workers, researchers, and just in full disclosure, in my case, I'm also an immigrant. I am one of those researchers, and I've been doing a fair bit of writing and research on coronavirus myself. Immigrants and refugees play a crucial role in caring for the elderly and infirm. Those who are not born in this country are 17%, almost one-fifth of the country's healthcare workforce. It's actually impossible to imagine the healthcare workforce without immigrants in it. Immigrants are 24% of direct care workers, like nursing, psychiatric, and home health aides, and 28% of highly skilled professionals, like doctors and surgeons. In other words, about one in four people who are delivering the essential services that the country relies on always, but particularly at the time of the pandemic, are immigrants. As the U.S. population continues to age and grow, we're only going to need more, not fewer people like us. America has had a long journey of trying to get this number of physicians right. As I suspect everybody on the call knows, we have a shortage of primary care physicians. By 2030, we could face a shortage of 120,000 physicians, which disproportionately affects rural America, with fewer physicians per capita than urban areas. Of the roughly 130,000 physicians, resident physicians in the U.S., about 30% are not U.S. born. If we stop that flow, we are going to simply have a shortage of physicians that will be catastrophic. So, summarizing, we have relied on immigrant physicians and healthcare workers to support our healthcare system for a long time. There is really no other way around this, and we simply cannot operate our healthcare system without people who are not born in the U.S. Imagine taking out 25% of the entire healthcare workforce, and you can all imagine the issues that it causes. So I think we're at a time where we need to really move beyond scapegoating immigrants and actually come up with a plan for how immigrant healthcare providers will continue on the front lines, keeping our communities safe, and to end on the point I started, to make sure that immigration prevention facilities do not facilitate the spread of COVID-19 and allow reservoirs of the virus to go unchecked, threatening the immigrants themselves, their staff, and their communities overall. I'll leave you over to you.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Our final speaker is Craig Regelbrug, Senior Vice President for Advocacy and Research at American Heart. Craig.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks, Ali. Yes, Craig Regelbrugger with American Heart. We are an agriculture and small business focused national trade organization. Immigrant labor is pretty much indispensable in the agricultural sector. Immigrants make up about 80% of the farm workforce. And roughly 200,000 of these workers are here or will soon be arriving on H-2A temporary work visas. H-2A is important across the country. The biggest user states are places like Georgia, Florida, Washington, North Carolina, and California. Many of these obviously are states where all or many residents are being asked to stay or required to stay at home except for essential activities. Experienced and skilled farm workers are defined federally as essential workers, and they support a critical infrastructure industry. I think it's fair to say that perhaps never in most of our lifetimes has the work that they do been more important to the security and stability of our society. And for this reason, we believe government and farmers must work closely together to ensure that we have the workers we need when and where we need them, with very high attention paid to their health, safety, and well-being. Fortunately, the federal government is recognizing the essential nature of the workforce, and as of now is continuing to process visas for most of these critical workers. We're also grateful that there is a dialogue going on among the departments of Agriculture, Labor, and Homeland Security, and for that matter, State Department, to discuss measures that they can implement now or soon to keep the program working well in these extraordinary times. We're grateful these discussions are going on. We hope that they very quickly turn to specific actions. Some may wonder about unemployed Americans. I'm not sure it's realistic to presume that temporarily unemployed Americans are necessarily going to pull up stakes and head to the fields. Most are, you know, frankly, hunkering down where they live. Many have responsibilities with children who are at home because schools and daycare are closed. Most are probably hoping that they'll be back to work in a matter of some weeks. And also, it's worth noting that the foreign worker approval process does prioritize the hiring of Americans first. I just want to conclude, though, by saying now more than ever, our agricultural sector needs a stable and skilled workforce, regardless of whether they were born in America or whether they were born someplace else. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. Just to close here, again, what we are making the case for through this conversation is that we are calling upon the administration and Congress to release a comprehensive, transparent plan which enables immigrants and refugees to access programs and services and continue to contribute to our healthcare system, our economy, and our communities without fearing negative immigration repercussions. And furthermore, as Chief Lopez laid out and Sandra laid out, it's important in terms of protecting the public health that the administration must move forward with the release of nonviolent immigrant detainees currently in detention facilities. So with that, operator, can you please provide the instructions for questions, please?
Certainly. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. And we'll pause for a moment to allow questions to queue.
Sorry, thank you. While questions are queuing, Ashley, if I could ask one question of you to provide a little bit more a sense of kind of what you are hearing from the diocese, whether it's you know, Sister Norma in McAllen or Bishop Seitz in El Paso or elsewhere across the border, along the border. What are you hearing from your colleagues along the U.S.-Mexico border that are serving asylees?
Sure. So absolutely, I think considering the spread of the virus, it's important to think about those communities along the border where you have very intermingled, you know, people who go back and forth in and out of Mexico. And then also the asylum seekers and some of our Catholic dioceses that are serving those individuals. First and foremost, I think we note that a lot of the Border Patrol officers are really doing their best, and I think that they are putting themselves out on the line, and we're so appreciative. But I think that there is a lot of concern about making sure that there's clear and transparent health guidelines and, frankly, assistance as it relates to helping to educate and prevent the future spread. Some of the workers there in McAllen out of the Catholic Charities are, you know, I think quite concerned about the care and the health of the asylum seekers and also the workers who are assisting them, humanitarian workers, as well as the Border Patrol agents. We also were concerned, I think, about the well-being of some of the unaccompanied children who we know who have still been coming, ensuring that they are in health and at least get testing if they exhibit symptoms is also a priority, I think, not only for their care, but for the general welfare of the entire community. It is a trying time, but I think we are all trying to work together to remember our common humanity and work with the federal government to the extent that they're able to issue guidance and information so that we can try and prevent this from spreading to, you know, all communities.
Thank you, Ashley. Operator, if we can take the first question, please.
Yes, sir. We'll go and take our first question from Sandra Sanchez with BorderReport.com. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks a lot. I'm actually in McAllen, and I cover the entire South Texas border. Great confusion among immigration lawyers and asylum seekers this week regarding the new regulations that are suspending all the MPP court cases at the judicial tent facility, yet the migrants are still required to wait in line over the bridges. And many of them are lining up 4 hours early because that's what they're required to do prior to going. Lawyers say they have not received communication from CBP or EOIR as to exactly what is supposed to happen. If they immigrants don't wait in line, then they don't receive court papers, which are called tear sheets, which in effect their visa for staying in Mexico. So, you know, do you have any, you know, calls, you know, suggestions for the government, what needs to happen here? There's great confusion, and these people are all clustered together on the bridge, definitely not social distancing.
Sure. So this
Ashley,
is Ashley,
do you want to take that, and then Jason, behind you, please.
Yeah, this is Ashley from USCCB, and I can just start a little, and I'm sure others can add. We and other service providers, you know, through our Catholic Charities, have requested guidance about the MPP hearings. It's my understanding that a general statement was released, I believe, Monday night, postponing MPP hearings into April. It was a joint DHS and EOIR statement. I think more clarification and guidance is needed and would be very welcome. I know, you know, to the extent possible, we've tried to encourage just general public health information for the humanitarian workers who are assisting in the camps in Matamoros as they're permitted to. We also, I know, Catholic Charities Rio Grande Valley under Sister Norma has been engaging with the Mexican government about general health care and welfare kind of provisions. But I do think that further guidance from EOIR and DHS on the hearing and kind of the requirements would be helpful and is very necessary.
Jason, is there anything you'd like to add here?
Sure. I think what's happening is it's the result of some of the problems, the underlying problems with MPP generally just to begin with. Because in order to get a new hearing date or the new papers, they do need to go and talk to the CBP agents at the border because they don't have an address for the people who are in MPP. So there's no way they can mail a notice. And so the only way they can communicate is for the people who are there to talk to the CBP agents who have information from the courts. And so they have to act as the go-between between the people who are seeking asylum and trying to get into the United States and continue their process. And so I think that just goes to show just some of the underlying problems with MPP to begin with. And I think the government, you know, really needs to be thinking about how to better, you know, keep track of people and better communicate with them and find other ways to, you know, address asylum seekers than just sending them over to shelters in Mexico.
As a quick follow-up, Global Response Management, which is the medical services providing on the ground in the Matamoros refugee camp, has raised enough money to open a hospital tent facility and also to bring over rapid testing kits for COVID-19. However, the Mexican government is not allowing these tests at this time. Do you think the United States should put force upon the Mexican government to request that these tests be crossed?
I mean, absolutely. This is Ali. I think that, you know, what we're reading just from from U.S. press just reporting on Mexico's preparedness in general, I think leaves us with a lot of concern, not just for the Mexican population at large, but also the folks who are on the Mexico side of the border. And I think it's really imperative that, you know, the Mexican and the U.S. government are collaborating on a solution that ensures that testing and treatment is available, and that the policies are put into place so that, you know, people are able to, you know, live in a safe way, because, you know, that wasn't the case before COVID-19, and it's certainly not the case now. Can we get the next question, please?
Yes, so we'll go ahead and take our next question from Maria Pina with Telemundo. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you for doing the call. So I have two questions. The courts have postponed trials and juries and other proceedings because of the pandemic. Can someone talk about how the immigration backlog and all the hearings that asylum seekers have pending, et cetera, on the one hand? And then the other, you know, ICE obviously is getting messages to release detainees from the detention centers, but instead of doing that, it's doing this massive deportations to Central America. Can you address that in the light of a hunger strike that I think is going on right now in a Louisiana detention center? Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Jason, did you want to take the first question in terms of the cases in the courts?
Maria was breaking up a little bit. Could you repeat the specific question?
Yeah, I heard that courts are canceling or postponing hearings and trials and all sorts of proceedings, and I'm wondering what impact that's having in the immigration courts with all the backlogs.
Yeah, that will continue. That will definitely exacerbate the backlogs because, you know, when a court case gets postponed, they just move it to the end of the line. It's not like they can move everybody else in. And they just are so tightly scheduled that they don't have the ability to add additional hearings and things like that. So that will definitely postpone and just keep the backlog in place. My understanding is that they're not bringing new, you know, they're not allowing new people to come in. So in some ways, they're not adding to the backlog because they're not having new cases.
Thank you. And in terms of your second question, and I'll turn this over also to Chief Lopez in terms of speaking to you know, what you saw and your fears are in terms of the detention facilities. But there certainly have been some sporadic reports over the last 24 hours of facilities releasing individuals who, but it's not clear, at least from the report so far, that if there's a set criteria for why people are being released, and it seems to be very much on a case-by-case basis, which is certainly not a public health approach. There's one report out of San Antonio where individuals had seen through the media the threat of COVID-19, had the officers in the facility had pepper sprayed them to, in essence, force them back into their cells, I believe, and then ICE, according to the report, went on to shut off media access within the facility. So it's clear that at a national level, there needs to be a clear decision and directive from DHS leadership of how facilities should be operating in this environment. But Chief Lopez, I just want to turn it back to you to see in terms of your thoughts on what is happening or what could be happening in the detention facilities.
Yes, hi, Ali. Thank you very much. This is Chief Lopez again. Maria, I'm unable to comment specifically regarding the hunger strike that you referenced. I don't know anything about that. Concerning the detention facilities, however, I can't imagine that as a country we don't want to reduce the risk of that we have potentially with COVID-19 by deporting that risk back to another country. We have to maintain a duty of care, and I think that option of reducing the at-risk population within our country is a viable option. Once you have that exposure to COVID-19, you don't have that option anymore. We are going to be responsible for maintaining the health and safety of those detainees, and that is our duty of care. That's a responsibility mm-hmm. we can't pass off to anybody else.
And the thing about the detention centers is that apparently there's already been a case of someone who came down with coronavirus, and you know the likelihood is that number will continue to spike. And so I guess I'm trying to understand what the directives are from ICE, because it seems like you're telling me that every facility is doing their own thing, and so I'm wondering if they're going to come out with a policy, or what's being done to pressure ICE to standardize what's going on right now.
And that's the entirety of the purpose of this. Go ahead.
Okay. This is Ashley Feasley, and we actually work in partnership with ICE over the years on alternatives to detention that have case management services. And so, you know, something that we feel would be at just a general policy relating to detention facilities that do not have, at this time, do not seem to be exposed to either detainees or workers, would be to think about, releasing those vulnerable populations that the chief mentioned, perhaps on an ATD with case management, and because they are more vulnerable, they could be able to access services from trained healthcare, professionals who are, in the community working on this. I think, of course, that needs to be tempered with whatever the latest guidelines are for those public health workers here in the community to ensure that the highest degree of safety. But I think that that is something that could be put forth as an idea to move forward, balancing ICE's concerns about, release of detainees. Also, with their legal obligation, there are segments of the population that are currently detained that do not have to be detained under the INA. This could be something that they could look to implement, in cooperation with local communities, and also in through the administration of their alternatives to detention electronic case management system. I think that there are certainly risks, but it is something that would be a proactive way for certain detention facilities who, again, have not experienced any sort of exposure to at least try and implement to protect all of those individuals from possibly receiving, exposure.
Thank you.
Galen or Sandra, is there anything you'd like to add to this particular question?
Well, certainly, this is Galen Carey again. Certainly one thing that we think ICE should be doing is not making the problem worse by adding new people into the detention system. There should be a moratorium except for very unusual cases and putting any more people into these situations where they're basically being trapped into infection.
Yeah, and the only thing I'll add to that is it is actually odd that we're even having this conversation, that we obviously have a health crisis, and what we need to do to mitigate it is also very clear, and it is actually impossible to condone in one's mind putting non-violent people who are not a threat in a situation which is going to make not just their health worse, but actually the health of everybody around them. So to my mind, this is inarguable and simply requires the right nudge for us to align our policies with what is good common sense.
Thank you. Operator, can we take the next question, please?
Yes, sir. We'll go ahead and take our next question from Saffold Alton with Frontline PBS. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
You might be on mute, or we lost you.
I was on mute. Thank you. I'm on mute. This question is for Craig regarding the agricultural workforce. We talk about the 80% immigrant workforce, but a lot in California is undocumented. So is there a conversation happening or a call for plans to protect those workers who don't have any paid sick leave, they don't have health insurance, they're actually very vulnerable and critical right now?
Conversations are happening. There certainly is a recognition. We have not hidden from the fact that a substantial portion, likely more than half, and perhaps even higher of the workforce is not legally present from an immigration standpoint. But yet they've been longstanding members of the community and contributing immeasurably in many ways. I think that with respect to the care picture, we are all scrambling to help our industry, our members understand the provisions of the Families First Act that just passed, which kick in April 1 and will affect many agricultural employers. We also are absolutely prioritizing outreach on prevention measures, sanitation measures. People are having to look at ways to rethink the work that needs to be done and how people get around to ensure distancing and safety. So that is all going on. I think there is a pretty high degree of apprehension out there about workers traveling and being questioned about why they're traveling. They, of course, have the plausible explanation, the legitimate explanation, that they are essential workers under the FISA guidance, the federal government's guidance, and that's been generally adhered to in the states as well. Obviously, the bigger picture solution that we need, I mean, we obviously need a serious solution that will ultimately take Congress acting. And, you know, most of our groups were very, very pleased to see the House pass bipartisan legislation last December. We're hopeful that the Senate will be up to the task. Obviously, the Senate, the distraction factor is high, and I think the nascent progress toward figuring a path on an agricultural bill has stalled out in the context of the crisis. But ultimately, that's really what's needed to get at the heart of the problem.
Great. Thank you, Craig. Can we take the next question, please?
Yes, and as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, that is star and one. And we'll go next to Diane Sliss with Dallas Morning News. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yeah, thank you very much for this call. I have a question for Chief Lopez about what should happen if somebody contracts coronavirus in detention. Did I understand correctly that you wouldn't want a COVID-19 exposed detainee simply deported back to their birth country in such cases?
Hi, good morning. My point is that obviously when anyone is detained in custody, whether it be a prison, a county jail, or immigration detention facility, we assume the duty of care. We, the government, the agency, assumes the duty of care. If we do have in specific answer to your question, if obviously this is a worldwide pandemic, we don't want to mitigate our risk by imposing that risk on another. I don't think that with respect to our duty of care, we would be required to maintain the health and safety of that person in our detention facility. I don't know the specific federal or immigration ICE detention guidelines. So I can't speak specifically to that, but I know that if we have an inmate in our facility that had a communicable disease, we have a responsibility, whether they remain in our custody or they're removed from our custody, to ensure that health and safety aspect of their welfare is maintained regardless of their final disposition.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Do we have any other questions in the queue, operator?
And it appears we have no further questions in queue at this time.
Pause to see if anybody else wants to get a last question in. Let me close by thanking the panelists for joining this conversation, this press conference this morning. Galen Carey with the National Association of Evangelicals, Ashley Feasley with the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops, Sandra Galea with the Boston University School of Public Health, Chief James Lopez, retired from the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, and Craig Regelbrug with American Hort. We will be sending out a statement and a recording of this press conference in the very near future. And if folks have questions for any of the speakers, please do reach out, and we are more than happy to connect you. Again, thank you very much for joining, whether you're a speaker or a audience member. And please, everybody, stay safe and stay healthy.
Thank you.